Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the roundtable for this Thursday morning. It is the 11th of February. We are very pleased that you are with us. It's snowing lightly. It's quite nice out, but it is snowing, and it's going to be just bitterly, brutally cold. So we hope that you take shelter. Our idea is you take shelter, you listen to the radio, and you come out when it's warm. That's basically what would be the plan for everybody.
I don't know that I agree with that.
All right.
There I was out in the, 4:15 this morning in the dark with my headlight, my new headlight on my head.
Yeah.
Walking out there, and I thought it was quite pleasant, almost like being in sunny Florida.
But it is not. But again, it is. I don't know what the temperature is now, but that wasn't the brutal, beating cold that we're supposed to get over the next couple of days.
Oh boy, yeah. When it goes down to zero, I can't.
Yeah, I mean, this is like 10 below. They're talking about. I mean, that's cold.
That's really cold. That's cold.
Time to burrow down. Well, good morning to everyone. Good morning to you, and of course, we welcome your letters. Panel@wamc.org. Panel@wamc.org. Alan Chartok is the aforementioned human with a headlight. Good morning, sir. How are you?
I can't resist when you said burrow down. I thought of brrr down.
That's right. That's right. Well, it's that too. Sure.
Yeah, I'm okay.
Okay, good. Excellent. We welcome counterterrorism expert, best-selling author, our dear friend, Malcolm Nance, to the program.
Yay.
Good morning, Malcolm.
Good morning.
Nice to have you here. Thank you for being with us. Siena College professor of comparative politics, Vera Akarius-Kelly is with us. Good morning, Vera.
Good morning, everyone.
Nice to have you here, and we welcome the Edward Hamilton Distinguished Professor of Computer Science at RPI. Also, the Catherine Hampson Bessel Fellow at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard University, Fran Berman. Good morning, Fran. How are you?
Good morning. I was dancing to that music. That was good stuff.
It was good stuff. Yeah, excellent. Mike, is that your choice? Yeah, Mike Bowen, providing our musical.
Nice job, Mike.
It's from Steve Earle's new album about his. It's sad because it's about his son who passed away, Justin Towns, who died of a drug overdose. But the album is beautiful. It's called JT, and it's out. And we'll be playing tracks throughout the morning. And you can see the playlist on our website. WAMC.org/roundtable. Okay, let us get started. We'll talk. Everyone is in. I didn't forget anybody, did I? We get started now and begin with the impeachment trial. The House impeachment managers emphasized the danger to Mike Pence and other top officials in a harrowing retelling of the January 6th attack. They led a rapt U.S. Senate on a retelling of the terror that engulfed the Capitol, sharing shocking new audio and video recordings of rioters declaring their intent to harm Vice President Mike Pence and other top officials, and showing how close they came to doing so. The House Democrats, led by lead manager Jamie Raskin, spent day two of former President Donald Trump's impeachment trial displaying violent video scenes of the January 6th attack and the rioters. Relentlessly raw language, including chants to hang Pence, and a sinister clip of a man looking for House Speaker Nancy Pelosi asking, Nancy, where are you, Nancy, in a very menacing way that I will not try to reenact. All of it, the impeachment manager said, was a direct result of the president's months-long effort to persuade his supporters of the big lie that the election had been stolen. After he had exhausted all other options to overturn President Biden's victory, they said, including dozens of lawsuits and a sustained campaign to pressure state election officials, Trump turned his sights to January 6th, the day Congress was scheduled to formalize Joe Biden's victory. Okay, so we now move on to day three today, and the House managers are expected to wrap up their opening arguments. So, Alan, where are we right now?
Well, first of all, I think that the managers have done a superb job, really superb, and putting it all together. You may notice that each of the people who have been speaking and speaking so well pick up a similar, folder, which obviously has what they're going to say in it. And they've done a great job. Now, I want to go to the Pence part of this thing. They talk about Pence, the managers. And the reason they're doing that is that the jury We know who's on the jury. The Democrats are going to vote for impeachment for the most part, except for one. The Republicans are where the problem is. So if you keep saying Pence, 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 and you show Pence fearing for his life and running with his family and moving out, then I think, you know, there's a clear intent to say to the Republicans, hey, look, this isn't only a Democratic-Republican thing. This is your vice president, and look at what they're doing to him. And now I defer to my betters, who all know more about this than I do.
Let's start with Malcolm Nance. Malcolm.
Yes, I thought that the first day of the managers bringing up all of the materials that led up to this showed a direct line between Donald Trump and the violence on the Hill. Now, this is common sense for all of us, but I want to call attention that all day yesterday, Fox News played not 1 minute of this. They didn't address this at all until it came on Tucker Carlson's show at like 7 or 8 o'clock at night. So, you know, there is actually this sort of bipolar media world right now where the true damage, the true emergency that happened during that attack is still only being seen by two-thirds of the country. One-third, and again, I monitor their chats in the early morning hours. I get up at 3 a.m. to monitor their chats and Telegram channels. Virtually none of them saw any of that video and on the right wing. And their leadership there, they don't care. This is all about circle the wagons on Donald Trump. I have to tell you, I was chilled at some of the stuff that I heard there, especially the police radio calls of how desperate and dire an emergency it was for the Metropolitan Police Department, who were actually running the front line around the building. And, you know, I've got a new book on right wing extremism what I think is a coming Trump insurgency. And, you know, in the interviews with the police officer, Mike Fanone, you know, these people were screaming in his face, kill him with his own gun, kill him with his own gun. It was a terrifying incident. And now the Republicans have circled the wagons, and they said you can't impeach Trump when he's president. You can't impeach Trump when he's a civilian. And I would like to hear Alan's thoughts on this. They actually made a pretty strong case that Trump should be tried criminally as a civilian.
I thought so. I thought that's exactly right. Malcolm, could we go back to your remarks for a moment there? And sure. Let me ask you, the coming insurgency that you just mentioned, could you tell us a little bit more about what you're seeing in the crystal ball?
Yeah. And, you know, if anybody saw actually, we talked about this during a good piece of the summer where I said this stuff was building up right here on this program. And when I went on Bill Maher's show on November 6th, 3 days after the election, you know, everybody on the show was all kumbaya, let's pull together. And I warned, I said, you know, I'm not seeing this. I'm going to give you doom and gloom. We have an insurgency coming. And when I say insurgency comes in three different phases. And this is a phase one insurgency, which is a rejectionist movement which views the current government as illegitimate, and they start with a political rejectionist front, and they have paramilitary and terrorist forces that will discredit this government so that it appears that no one can be made to feel safe except for this quote-unquote president in exile that Donald Trump is. And in fact, the insurrection on January 6th is likely going to be the first. You know, right now they're building up amongst themselves and in their little Fox News and QAnon bubble that, you know, that we are now occupied by communists. And you know, Joe Biden is inviting hundreds of thousands of Chinese soldiers into the United States. It's nuts, but it's nuts with guns. And they are really starting to think that they're living some fantasy of being in the first throes of, you know, of defending Lexington and Concord. It's really like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, the way that they think that they live in this reality as the only true Muslims in Islam. These guys in Trump's army are technically viewing themselves as the only true patriots. And it's like that little joke that's been going around about, you know, how one of these Donald Trump QAnon followers dies and goes to heaven. And when he gets to St. Peter's gates, he says to St. Peter, St. Peter says to him, "Why are you here?" And he said, "Because I defended Donald Trump. I defended America and died in it." And St. Peter says, "Well, the election wasn't stolen and QAnon is fake." And the guy who died says, "My God, the conspiracy goes even higher than I thought." That's what we're dealing with.
Yeah. All right. Now that you have appropriately scared the zippers off of us, Vera.
So I wanted to also mention one of the issues that really affected me when I was watching these videos. I agree that, you know, about the strategy and how effective it was, at least for those of us who already know there's a relationship between, you know, what Trump said and what the group or these mobs of terrorists did, right? We right. understand that. We believe in the incitement, but I also at the same time, it is clear already that a fair number of the senators do not see that linkage. They are going to vote along the lines of, well, yes, that was criminal conduct, but Trump has nothing to do with it. So we know that is likely the outcome. But personally, I have to say, watching these videos and receiving the additional information, hearing the sounds, the whole audio reminded me of incidents in Latin America, in the Middle East, when I watched these absolutely, these angered mobs gathering in their mercilessness, in sort of this rabid foaming at the mouth behavior that is reinforced in these crowds, and to see what Capitol Police had to face, looking out and seeing thousands of these people pushing towards them, beating them, calling on them to be, you know, attacked, subdued. It reminded me so much of some of those incidents that many of us who travel internationally or work internationally in areas where we have insurgencies and deeply angered groups of populations rising up, right?
Yeah.
And I thought, oh my gosh, this reminds me so much of those sort of observations and sentiments where, you know, it doesn't matter what you have done or what you not have not done. If the crowd comes for you, there's absolutely no control of emotions, no control of this kind of violence and this level of anger. And that is exactly what we saw. And
well,
extremely dangerous.
Well, you mentioned all those other countries, but of course, your home country, Germany, wrote the playbook on how this is done, yes?
Well, I mean, what I'm saying is, in my personal lifetime, I've experienced those kinds of things, right? When you talk about my grandparents, of course, you know, that in essence, when you look at the pogroms, you know, Kristallnacht, those types of events, the same sort of mobs coming for people, targeting a particular subgroup, an ethnic group, a religious group. I mean, all these comments you make and the comments Malcolm made are all fitting together. It's all a puzzle of how these kinds of dynamics emerge and how dangerous it is. And to see that happen at the Capitol is shocking to the core each time. Each time, I think, it reinforces what a dangerous situation we're in.
Just about 90 seconds before we have to go to a break, but Fran Berman.
I had two reactions to this, and you know, first of all, I think that the arguments were exquisitely done. And, you know, it makes you think, well, if this isn't impeachable stuff, what is? Mm-hmm. And you know, really, I mean, they did a fabulous job of creating a story around really tragic and incredibly harrowing activities. But really what made me, you know, it also made me think about sort of the broader comment on culture, that we are in such an amalgam of separate realities due to all of this polarization, that there's so little empathy from one side to the other, and that the difference between the lived experience and the observed experience, you know, I think for the people in Congress that day and for many of us, you know, it was just so present. On the other hand, you know, for lots of other people, it was like TV. It was like fantasy. It was like maybe it didn't exist. And that kind of thing scares me because we see that all the time. And I think that makes things very, very difficult in terms of ever trying to get any kind of cohesiveness and any kind of community that's really going to help us get out of this craziness.
But there is right and wrong, right? There's just right and wrong in this. We want to get together.
Need to pause, and we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your comments, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Malcolm Nance, Vera Carius-Kelly, and Fran Berman make up the program this morning. We'll continue the conversation, include your letters, and move on to other subjects as well. First, we have news from the BBC. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
Like a sister one, I'm an Army of Virginia man. Been from Manassas to Tobacconia all the way to Sailor's Creek, fighting for my homeland.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable on this Thursday morning, 34 minutes past 9 o'clock. Alan Chartok, Malcolm Nance, Vera Acarius-Kelly. We have Fran Berman as well, and we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. So, as this trial goes on, the key word here is incitement. The Supreme Court has placed strict First Amendment limits on incitement charges in court, but many legal scholars say they do not apply in impeachment trials. So you have Representative Jamie Raskin, the Democrat of Maryland and the lead impeachment manager, saying yesterday that Mr. Trump's words that day on January 6th met any conceivable standard for incitement. Mr. Raskin said Donald Trump surrendered his role as commander-in-chief and became the inciter-in-chief of a dangerous insurrection, adding that Mr. Trump's actions were, quote, the greatest betrayal of the presidential oath in the history of the United States. So when it comes to that word incitement, Malcolm Nance, how far will it go during an impeachment trial?
Well, amongst adults who use education, erudition, common sense, and law, it should go a very, very, very long way. I mean, there's a very simple case that Donald Trump drove those people to do this. He stoked them up. You know, if you don't want to use the word incitement as a legal term, you could say that he directed them. And many people, you know, there's been over 500 cases, over 200 indictments, you know, an arrest of these insurrectionists and seditionists. They themselves say Donald Trump told them to do it and they were coming there following his orders. So if you can't understand the definition of the word incite, then you're just a Republican politician who, I'm sorry, I mean, after watching what I saw yesterday, seeing how close Mitt Romney came to running into a mob that a policeman was running from, you know, that, you know, as Eric Swalwell said, they were 58 paces, the House of Representatives, from an actual mob that was being held back by the Capitol Hill police, and that Vice President Pence, Leader Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, you know, all of them, their security details had all weapons drawn, preparing to carry out what could only arguably called a massacre if it had come to that. He incited this. And anyone, I got to tell you, anyone that doesn't go along with this, the 44 Republicans thus far, they need to be shamed every minute of the day. They need to be called the Sedition Caucus because they're siding with the goals of what Trump did, and they're willing to keep him in power to keep themselves in power so that they can get on an airplane nicely without being yelled at and to be patted on the back by people who should be ashamed of themselves for what they did. I mean, this came to murder. They killed a policeman in cold blood. They were trying to kill policemen left and right. And this is the caucus who says that blue lives matter and that they side with the cops. But in their mind and in their base right now, the United States is broken in their minds. It's a fantasy of the fracture that they've manufactured themselves. We have to, you know, we really should just not let these people eat publicly anymore. You know, these people are broken the United States, and they're about to completely smash the Republican Party as a seditionist party.
Alan.
Well, I couldn't possibly say it better than Malcolm just said it. I didn't disagree with a single word he said. We are in a hell of a pickle that we have people in this country who have forgotten all about patriotism, and that's all I got to say. I think it's unbelievable.
Fran?
Well, let's get real. I mean, it's just hard to imagine any reality in which, you know, Trump and the Republicans think that this was not direction to incite. You know, it's like saying, you know, when Bill Clinton said he didn't have sex, let's get real. You know, this, he incited those people, he directed those people to misbehave, and they misbehaved plenty, and they misbehaved in really scary and tragic ways. And, you know, I mean, so this sort of standing on ceremony and, you know, like, I'm going to be on my side no matter what happens. I just have to say, you know, I can't fathom that you would sort of stick to your side no matter what.
Yeah.
Especially when you're a public servant. I mean, this is, you know, frankly, this is sort of what gets to me about all of this behavior, that it's really all about sides. It's not about the public interest. It's not about human decency. It's not about any of that stuff. Incitement. Yeah, it looks to me like incitement. And I'm not a lawyer, I have to say. I'm a data scientist. But I think any reasonable interpretation of incitement, would stand.
Vera. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I agree with what Fran said. What we're seeing right now is a trial, an impeachment trial. And the purpose of this impeachment trial and all these proceedings is really recording what took place for history and possibly eventually shaming these Republicans who voted to not convict Trump. I mean, I cannot imagine what the history books will say in the future, listing certain senators, listing certain representatives from specific states with their names as having not recognized this conduct by the former president as incitement, and rejecting the sort of logical sequencing that is happening that we see. So it's a process through which we will record all of the details of what took place and eventually be able to shame these supposed political representatives that we have in this country.
We got, you know, that. Go ahead.
You know, Joe, we're getting a lot of letters on history and what history will say about this. And the only thing I can say, and I take us back to what Malcolm said earlier, it depends on who wins. If this insurrection is successful that Malcolm is talking about, they'll write the history books. Otherwise, forget it.
Well, I don't think they're winning, because otherwise we would have seen a different outcome. What we're seeing is we're getting information, we're getting videos, documents, footage, new recordings, audio recordings from police, Capitol Police. We get a lot of information that will be used eventually to strengthen specific laws, and the FBI is obviously trying to track down every single violent offender.
But Malcolm, you're saying this isn't over,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and I think that's right, Vera, and I think that, you know, like, think about that. That's courtesy of technology. you know, a decade or two ago, we would never have gotten information that was essentially eyewitness information at this level and at this volume to be able to piece together a really comprehensive story. So, you know, everything has pluses and minuses, and I'll certainly could talk for hours on the pluses and minuses of technology. But in this sense, I think we were really, we really get to put together what it looked like from all points of view.
So, Fran, are you sure? In other words, are you sure that technology, which has seems not to have swayed many Republican senators, will be the deciding factor in all of this?
No, no, that's not my point, Alan. My point is that the technology really gives you a much more comprehensive picture of what happened than, you know, than 20 years ago we would have been able to have through, you know, traditional kind of mechanisms.
Yes, but you still don't have 16 Republican senators.
You know, what will change their mind? Yeah. I have no idea. You know, as I said, you know, I think I, you know, for me it looks like, you know, people are looking at party at all costs. And I don't understand that point of view. I mean, I'll tell you very frankly, I don't understand why you would put your party first when you're an elected, you know, at all costs when you're an elected official.
Well, I can explain that.
Me too.
They put party at all costs because of two factors. One, they are terrified of their own base.
They now
understand that this base is a violent, virulent, you know, almost uncontrollable group of people who see party and their own, you know, their own position in the United States as more important than the nation at all. I say this before, you know, they don't believe anymore, Republicans, and I'm talking to you Republicans that are listening. They don't believe in E Pluribus Unum anymore. From many one. They believe in unum tribus domine. One tribe will dominate. And, you know, as far as they're concerned, if it is not the white male base conservative tribe that is led by this charlatan, Donald Trump, who they know he's a liar, they know all these terrible things about him, but they don't care. Because I see this all the time in their own writings and their own communication. He's the guy that stood up for the crazy things they wanted. And the crazy things they wanted required him to be a bigot, a racist, a white supremacist, and to use all tools of government, you know, to do what they want for what they think is good for them, even though they know they're getting their pockets picked. It is straight up out of the what I think it was Lyndon Johnson said that if you tell the poorest white man, uneducated white man, that he is better than the richest, most educated black man, he'll empty his pockets for you. Trump delivered on that. And now the only thing they're disappointed with is that Trump didn't use the military to essentially wipe us out in the great storm like QAnon was promising. But Trump is about Trump and money. And he's taken his money, and now he's thinking about running again with a new MAGA party or the Patriot Party. But his people don't care at all.
You know, Malcolm, I don't disagree with any of that. I mean, I'm on board with that. But I do think that, you know, we all created this. You know, this is not something that, you know, like some really awful group of people were kind of born doing that. We all created the environment where there's permissiveness for this kind of behavior, where there's, you know, continuation of systemic racism, systemic sexism, systemic intolerance, and all of that. And so I do think that, you know, the solution can't just be like, you know, throw them out or like tamp them down or put them all in jail or something like that. You know, we have to change the culture in which this stuff thrives.
Yeah, well, first off, let me rebut real quick. I, as an African-American man, I didn't create this. I spent my entire life defending all of you so that you could have your way and your freedom of speech and all of that stuff. But, you know, I'm sorry. I've been watching this from an intelligence professional's perspective. If this were Burundi, I would be saying the exact same thing. There is a tribe that is out of control, in which they have personalize their most vicious base thoughts for domination of the nation. And, you know, this happened in Rwanda. I took part in that operation when, you know, they were talking on radio using what we call in the intelligence community eliminationist rhetoric. That's where where you want to kill your fellow citizens. I've been seeing eliminationist rhetoric left and right. There was a movement leading up to the election amongst right-wing extremists and what they called for, quote, Democrat extinction, unquote. These people are out of control because the system of decency that we've had forever, where you couldn't come into the public forum with crazy thoughts of wanting to murder people, that has been gone. It was Newt Gingrich is responsible for all of this in government, and the Democrats aren't. We are not talking about mass murdering our peers. We're talking about kumbaya. That's not what they're talking about. And I have literally spent the last 5 years writing books, television and radio, trying to warn you of these crazy threats. But it is not both sides do it. It's not at all.
So I wanted to also mention a comment on this whole issue, because now I believe that we will see a transition to lone actors in this country increasingly. I think this sort of idea that QAnon is, you know, now organizing mass group kind of resistance in lots of places, I think this might take a while. Maybe, you know, we will see sort of this larger scale organizational structure within the next decade or so. But I'm most worried right now, and Malcolm can speak to that perhaps in more detail, these lone wolf actors that are now beginning to get so deeply frustrated that they feel wronged. They feel deeply disappointed and angered, having bought into specific ideas of resistance, and now they're acting on their own. And that is something that we will likely have to be exceptionally careful about, and that is the hardest kind of violence to track.
We need to take a break, and we will be back. We have letters, and we'll do that. It's panel at WAMC.org is where you can write. Panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Malcolm Nance, Vera Carius Kelly, and Fran Berman make up the panel. We'll return right after this. Morning. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Panel at WAMC.org. We have a lot of letters, so let me get to those in our time to our top of the hour break. Robert says, hey, did you see Senator Hawley taking the proceedings so seriously, reading a newspaper? This callousness is so typically Republican. I hope the people in his district pay attention and remember his impertinent behavior. Certainly was not the only one in that group doing it, but there you go. Jonathan says, please address the Trump campaign's funds and the payments to the insurrectionists. Malcolm, what do we know about that?
Yeah, there's a lot of media reporting about this now. Some of them are really weird. Like there was a French multimillionaire, a very young guy who was dying from a chronic disease, who transferred $250,000 in Bitcoin to Enrique Torres, the head of the Proud Boys, and this young French guy checked into a hotel in Paris and shot himself. That was one source of funds. Then the real money that that the New York Times and others are investigating are the funds that were transferred from the Trump campaign itself. And it appeared that the Trump campaign funded most of this rally. It was a campaign event. It wasn't just a march. The one that I really think needs a lot more investigation and a lot more noise about is Ginni Thomas, the right-wing extremist wife of Justice Clarence Thomas, who she herself organized along with Charlie Kirk and some other people, like 60 busloads of people, to come to this rally. These people need to be held to account for how and why they did all of this. And I don't think that, you know, after the acquittal, this should go away. I know the, you know, Joe Biden wants to settle back and, you know, just, you know, keep going with the coronavirus thing. But if we don't have accountability on this, where there were murders and deaths and, you know, forced shootings on the Capitol by people who are reconstituting, then we're going to have this trouble again. Joe, can I quickly touch on that previous question about lone wolves?
Sure.
So the question, you know, the point was that, you know, that you should be afraid of lone wolf terrorists coming up. And that's true. You know, we do have these frustrated individuals. But I've got almost 100,000 words written on the right-wing extremists and this coming insurgency that's been building for 3 years. They're organizing. They're organizing like you can't believe. I mean, the Proud Boys, the Three Percenters, the Oath Keepers. You know, I read yesterday on a forum, they said, oh, we're not organized. We don't get together in units and teams. Yes, they do. They do. They communicate with disparate means by Facebook and, you know, Discord and other communications platforms. But they get together for shooting club. They get together for tactical training. And that's not even the militias, of which there's several right here in New York State. There's one in my county, in Columbia County, you know, who are all thinking that when the balloon goes up and rule of law collapses and they have to fight for Trump, they're going to get together and form these organizations. What you saw at the Capitol was that organization structure come together and congeal.
So, Malcolm, what do you think about the issue of a certain percentage of active military, retired military, former members of police departments, and so on, as participants of these organizations?
Yeah, a lot of cops, I got to tell you. But, you know, let me tell you something about policemen. 90% of policemen never serve in the armed forces. They are high school graduates who go to police academy and then become policemen. And I know personally that, like, what's his name? Alex Jones had a 6 policemen around him at the Capitol who were all active duty cops protecting him with badges,
yes.
You know, who were of a like mind. Military people, you know, the military is a very big organization, not a moral combat soldiers. You know, we saw that fighter pilot that was arrested who was in the Senate chambers and everything. So that only gives you a bit of organization. But let me tell you, when you mass 40,000 people together and you've got a few key leaders, you don't have to be military to create mayhem, as we've seen.
All right, we have just a minute or two before we have to go to the top of the hour break. So let me get to some letters. Harry says, what were the rules for the use of deadly force at the Capitol on January 6th? I'm even more amazed now how disciplined the police were. Interesting point. We go to Daisy, who says, speaking to Malcolm's words today, did anyone hear the NPR report this morning? It says 4 in 10 Republicans say political violence may be necessary. And this belief is particularly strong in the white evangelical community. Yikes. How do we ever unravel from this?
This is I saw that this morning. It's going. I've just actually copied that statistic to go into my book. By the way, if you'd like to know the title of my next book, now that it's been announced, it's called "They Want to Kill Americans."
They want to kill Americans.
That is true. That is a fact. These people don't have a problem with this. They are living this fantasy that they are the Wolverines in the movie Red Dawn, and that all of us are in communist Chinese occupied liberal America, and they view us as hostile, as enemies, and a lot of them do that. 40% saying they're willing to fight. Again, they live in this hermetically sealed fantasy bubble that has been fostered by Fox News. Now that, you know, Trump is off Twitter, Trump is actually using his silence quite strategically, because when he comes out, and I think he'll probably make his first statement on air, probably on Fox News and OANN right after his acquittal, because we know he's going to get acquitted, and it's a question of whether he calls this to war and claims he is president of the United States or not. This is going to a very bad place. I don't think this is going to end well.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have many more letters. I do want to get to the letters. And we remind you that you can write one, too. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to the panel discussion for this morning. Malcolm Nance, Vera Akarius-Kelly, and Fran Berman. Alan Chartok here, of course, and we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Okay, let's get to the letters that I've been promising. I don't see the darkness coming, says Michael Trump, and his people will fade. They're fading already, becoming more and more fringe. Biden is such a good and gentle person. He will set an example and move forward with decency and goodwill. Good will triumph over evil. It always does.
Well, I believe in some of that, Joe. There's parts of it I don't. I think that this group has been around, the antithetical ones, since the Civil War. I mean, I don't know how Malcolm feels about it, but I think a good portion of this country has always been racist and mean-spirited and comes for a long time from the same place that the losers of that Civil War were.
Malcolm?
Oh, I agree with that. And I think it's very clear to us now, 5 years later, that it really exploded with Newt Gingrich politicizing, anti-liberalism and allowing the people who back in the 60s, the John Birchers and, all these other disparate Klansmen and who were, under their hoods, were sort of given a political platform, were given a cover. Clinton, attacking Clinton brought their hatred of progressivism and anything liberal out. And then when Obama won, good God, a black man in the White House, it just became overtly racist. I mean, the violent attacks at the Capitol on a Democratic senators and congressmen because they wanted to give everyone health care is insane. Leading up to Trump, Trump is the standard bearer, all right? He is really their tribal chief, Führer, if you will. And he has promised them essentially the moon, but he really meant welfare and corporate money, government money is for you, the white tribe, not for anyone who's liberal, anyone who's progressive, anyone who's people of color. I mean, he said this stuff out loud. When I was on Bill Maher, Bill was trying to say, don't you think it's time to talk to them and bring them in? And I said 74 million of them voted knowing everything that we know. And they literally, in most of his craziest forms, refer to Trump as not President of the United States, POTUS, but G-E-O-T-U-S, God Emperor of the United States. I wish this was a joke. They do it in all sincerity. The worst people in this country have changed their values due to propaganda. And Fox News, I blame them, OANN, Breitbart, all of these outlets that allowed them to have an information bubble in which reality cannot intrude, and that their racism, their abuse of others, and their belief that, the United States is really only for one tribe and not for everybody is what's destroying this country today. And the only way you're going to get at them, I wrote a Washington Post op-ed about this 2 weeks ago. You've got to shame them. And I mean shame them, call them out when you say, do you really support murdering policemen at the Capitol? Do you support these things? I mean, at least Stefanik and people in our my district here are all, making apologies for Donald Trump. You can't just say, that's the way they see things. No, you have to recalibrate them back to common decency because they don't want common decency to be part of the equation anymore.
Joe, I think that the reader's letter, I like their sentiments, but I do think, I was thinking the other day that You know, it's only been like 3 weeks since the inauguration. And, you know, think about how differently this country feels. You know, it does feel, because of the choices that the Biden administration has made about, you know, who's making decisions and the processes by which decisions get made, by who gets included, by, you know, who is the target for legislation and policy and all of that. It's a lot more empowering than it was. There's a lot bigger cross-section of America involved. You know, I do think that depending on the party and the people involved, you know, you're going to get these extremes and you're going to get these ups and downs. But for now, you know, there's like no point in giving up. And I do really appreciate, you know, the graduate school try that the new administration is making to take the more egregious things that are going on and that have been put in place by the last administration to mitigate the risk and make things go better, to improve our standing with other foreign powers, to, you know, create laws that are more environmentally friendly and more population friendly, to, you know, put the economy back into a better place, to take the coronavirus and the pandemic seriously. And so, yeah, I mean, I think Malcolm is really good at telling us what a bummer the world is. And I don't think he's wrong. But I do think that's not the only thing that's going on. And I am, while I'm scared for all of the same things that Malcolm and others are scared about, you know, I'm really heartened that we do have some folks in the White House at this minute, and they are trying to exercise their powers to put things in a good direction. So, you know, in a way, I agree with the reader that, you know, there is cause for, you know, hope. You know, there's lots of causes for concern, for sure. But there's also causes for hope, and I don't think we should forget about that.
I wanted to just make a quick comment. I think all of those remarks are at the intersection of what happened with the pandemic. I think while we had, you know, sort of the creation of a really closed kind of communication system through social media platforms among some of the, you know, members of the QAnon and conspiratorial and sort of violent militia groups, we also now have we're in this place where a lot of people are economically concerned. They worry about their children's future, where their place is in society in the near future. And all of this sort of was in this really nasty cauldron. And I do agree that we now have an opportunity, if we can get at least a large percentage of this population, and then, of course, most importantly, also other countries, everybody vaccinated, so that we can return to a more global exchange and travel. I think that an opening up of society will only help us return to certain moral and ethical principles. I think the pandemic brought out the worst in many people, and I think trying to address all of the socioeconomic and technological challenges we have following the pandemic, I think, is exceptionally important.
All right. Let's go to some other letters here. Suzanne says, even if the Republicans claim not enough evidence, Trump incited the mob, isn't there enough that Trump's declined to intervene as he was bound to do? That is also impeachable. Also, has Malcolm heard any chatter about right-wingers predicting that Trump will be back in power early March?
Yeah, that's a thing. That's a QAnon conspiracy theory, where once the inauguration happened, they shifted from Trump will take over the government with a storm of military people, arrest and then execute all the liberals and Hollywood elite pedophiles that make up the United States government. That didn't happen. So they came up with this bizarre theory that Washington, D.C. is not actually a place in the United States, that it was not the United States, but an incorporated zone. and that Donald Trump on March 4th will actually become the first, the 19th original president of the contiguous United States that do not include the District of Columbia. It's nuts. Another problem with March is that that's when the Republican Party is going to be having a giant convention, and Trump is expected to speak there. So it's up to anybody's guess as to what kind of craziness is coming out. But, you know, quick point about something that was made earlier. The Republican Party will be completely consumed by right-wing and QAnon ideology by the end of this year. I see it. It's happening. If they don't change their name to Patriot Party or MAGA Party, that'll be great. But they are shifting to the fringe of the fringe because they're afraid of their voters.
Let's see. We have a few minutes here before the break, so I do want to go back to letters. The Republicans that choose to ignore the facts of Trump's actions as incitor-in-chief may one day become a victim of it. It's time to come together and show unity to stop the bully on the Washington playground. Then Roberto, who writes, Malcolm is right. This is the first major attempt to overthrow the democracy with others to follow. Any senator voting against impeachment is most likely intending to assure themselves a position of power in the imminent new order under rulership of the Trump royal family while still maintaining an air of normality in the meantime. Gene says, what is the panel? I think I didn't read that one, but I read one that was close to it. Let's see. Mike says, it occurs to me that there is one and perhaps only one scenario in which both the Republican Party and democracy can continue to exist. That is, the Republicans vote unanimously to convict. The Democrats might be able to save democracy without the Republicans, but for the Republicans to be included requires showing the extremists that there is no place for them in the Republican Party or in the United States of America. Scott says, does anyone... I'm sorry?
I said, I wish.
Scott says, does anybody know why the impeachment managers are not showing the short video taken at Trump's bunker on the afternoon of the insurrection? It shows him and his sons and entourage partying to rock music while watching the bedlam on TV live at the Capitol. That actually is not... That's been debunked, too, actually. That is from prior to the storming of the Capitol and was before he went on at the rally in question. So,
Joe, I'd like to read one from Mike who says, Malcolm, I'd like to know your opinion of the idea that a big factor behind Trump's destruction of so much in this country was / is Putin. Thanks for Mike.
Well, we've played that out to death. You know, I mean, for years.
I don't think so. I don't think it's enough.
All that's left to come is the actual details of Trump's relationship with Putin. And as you guys know, I've written 3 books, all New York Times bestsellers, on the Trump-Putin intelligence relationship. And it's deep and it's close. But more importantly is the fact that the Russians saw all of our inherent racism. That's why they backed Trump. They started funding him in 2012 for his run for the election when he was at the Miss Universe pageant, because they understood America has fault lines that could deeply fracture this country. And, you know, now that they were no longer the Soviet Union, they could use all their rich money, all of, you know, Russian oil money, to bring the United States into what is essentially their camp, which is an autocracy run by oligarchs. And Trump is an oligarch. So that influence that they did in 2016, they got Trump to that point, but then Trump took it from there and ran.
So I wanted to say on the issue of Russia, something very important. It's not that the Russian intelligence officers are so bright to figure out what our fault lines are. They use the exact same methodology inside their own country against Muslim minorities or any other migrants. And they have deeply racist, anti-Semitic militias, motorcycle gangs, and all kinds of organizations that target minorities in Russia. So they are very familiar with those techniques, and they just simply copy and paste for our context. So
that's true.
Yeah, that's really useful there.
But don't you all think that there's something, you know, even more, forget about philosophical, but personal that the Russians and Trump have? I mean, I'm not a conspiratorialist, but we do know that he spent a lot of time there. And we do know that there was a certain amount of stuff that might have put him into a bad spot. So I'm thinking some of this may be less philosophical than more personal.
Yeah, well, that's a really good question, and I mean, Malcolm may know, but, you know, is it more than narcissism and power?
Well, you know, again, I wrote in my last book the same thing that Craig Unger just wrote a whole book about, which was that Trump was under KGB surveillance since 1977 when he married Ivana. And from 1977 to 1988, her father was the Czech intelligence reporting entity on everything about Donald Trump. So when Trump wanted to go to the Soviet Union in 1988, they already had 10 years of background information on him. They knew he wanted to run for president in 1988 before anyone in the United States did. They have a phone call between Ivana and her father talking about that. So from 1988 until the, until today, granted, when the Soviet Union fell, those files didn't get thrown away. They sat there until Vladimir Putin requested them in 2014 to talk about, hey, this guy Donald Trump wants my support. He's coming to Miss Universe. He started talking in 2012 about running for president of the United States. This man, Putin, is a spy master. I mean, he wasn't the greatest spy in the world. I've been to his office in Germany, but he was a dedicated KGB officer, a devout communist until he became a billionaire. And he knows how to manipulate people. He just used the knowledge that they knew about Trump and the apparatus of Russian intelligence. They put frames around Trump till it appeared that Trump and Putin were speaking the same thing. Does he owe Putin money? Of course he does. We're going to find out what it is, though. I certainly hope so.
Dorothy writes, it's been shown that 60% of the mob has financial problems such as large debt, bankruptcy, etc., and not just due to the pandemic. Though that could exacerbate their plight, their financial problems go back often for a decade or two. Does their grievance make them feel entitled to act as they did, as connected to their financial problems? Certainly many others in the country share their issues, but they don't act out. Is there a degree of mental instability that puts the rioters and fringe groups over the edge? And that's an interesting point, and it was in an exclusive, in the Washington Post about this. Yeah, go ahead.
One of the things I would say matters is if you feel economically or socioeconomically insecure, and you have this sense that because you are from a certain background, racially or ethnically, that you deserve to live better, and you just simply have a right to be to be at least in middle class, if not rise above others. And your sense of falling down this sort of social hierarchy, instead of climbing the ladder, you're being reduced to increasing economic stress. Mm-hmm. That enrages you if you're white male often. I mean, there's a certain segment of society that feels entitled to be in a certain socioeconomic position. And that is something that adds to it. Also, may I point out that there is a very, very, very small percentage of that group of people who own passports to travel anywhere. They're very much focused mm-hmm. on their, you know, local area. They have very little travel experience, even out of state. I mean, for a lot of these people, going to Washington, D.C. was a major experience to travel that far. So the sentiment, sense of self, expectation, and lived experiences of a fair percentage of that group is important to consider.
Malcolm?
You know, you guys are going to jump all over me for this, but okay. I have to say
Fran.
Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
Sorry. I can't see you all, so I don't know who's talking.
I'm sorry.
My apologies. But, you know, you all will probably jump all over me for this, but
you know, and from my own point of view, you know, Trump supporters are not a different species. They're not, you know, but I think that disenfranchisement breeds extreme behavior, a cultural environment where you don't have opportunities, where the information you get is limited and biased, in which, you know, all of this stuff is reinforced, is going to breed okayness for this kind of behavior. But these people are not different species. And that gets back to what I was saying before. You know, like, you know, how are we creating this? How are we all creating this? And how are we, you know, making it go into the future so we're more and more polarized and we get to this space where, you know, things are fragmented beyond fixing? You know,
so, Fran, I wanted to just mention there's a huge difference between Trump supporters in general and the people we just talked about. We talked about the extreme fringe. I know a lot of people who are Trump supporters who voted for Trump and now are really concerned about what happened and no longer think that was a good choice. But what we're talking about here is the fringe group that was analyzed in terms of their level of socioeconomic standing and their marginalization, so, you know, the marginalization and lack of sense of self economically and their sense of entitlement. But I'll let Malcolm talk about it.
Well, I think that's a fair point, Vera, but I think we often conflate the two, which I think is, you know, not helpful. I'm sorry, Malcolm, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm done with the economic anxiety argument that people made was magnified by the New York Times 100 times in the last 5 years. They are not economically marginalized. They found that I believe the estimate was that the median Trump voter was making between $75,000 and $100,000. They were not the lower class, as you might think, which might explain the Trump truck parades and the Trump boat parades. Let me tell you something. I monitor these people. These people are buying ammunition voraciously now. They joke amongst each other about when they get their $600 or $1,200 government check about what kind of ammo or what kind of new gun they're going to buy. Ammunition prices for an AR-15 from last year went up from 25 cents a bullet to $1.25 a bullet now, not in New York State. I'm talking about other states that actually have ammunition. These guys are not economically impacted as much as any more than the rest of the country. What's impacted is their sense of entitlement, that
yes,
they own America, that they hate blacks, they hate brown people, they hate women, they hate liberals, and they hate the Native Americans and anyone who is not going to live by their standards. And I'm sorry, for those people who you call friends who are Trump voters, and I have some,
well, I mean, I excuse me, Malcolm, but I think you ought to be careful accusing me of having certain types of people among my friends.
I'm talking your friends.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify that.
Can we hear it?
Knowingly. I'm saying they voted for Trump knowing this. They are not, we are all the same species, but we're not all the same tribe. And this is pure tribalism. Like I saw in New Guinea, right? Every tribe in New Guinea is afraid of every other tribe because they've not developed past that. They never made alliances. These people think they are the dominant tribe and that they should always remain the dominant tribe, demographics be danged. And they are willing to fight for it. I'm just trying, as an intelligence professional, I'm just trying to warn you all that this is not as neat and cut and dried and that all we have to do is understand them to let them, you know,
right,
for them to come back into the fold. They think they are the fold, and the other 65% of the country should be ruled by them.
We have to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll wrap up with Alan Chartok, Malcolm Nance, Vera Karius-Kelly, and Fran Berman. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Last call for the panel this morning. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us, and we welcome you. We just have a few more minutes here, and Alan, Malcolm, Vera, and Fran are all with us. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. So let us talk about Georgia. We'll change the subject. Georgia prosecutors have opened a criminal inquiry into Trump's efforts to subvert the election. We talked a little bit about this earlier in the week. State officials are being instructed, meaning talking about it, wondering whether they would do it. State officials are being instructed to preserve documents related to attempts to influence the Georgia election just weeks after former President Donald Trump asked an elections official to, quote, find votes. Alan.
Well, pardon me. No, well, what's clear is that we are now looking at a whole bunch of things that are going to be decided in the courts, whether you can take on a sitting president after he was president and accuse him of criminal activity. I certainly hope you can. The history of this country has not been that good on this. And, good for Georgia. I mean, those guys who were put upon by the president are now having, well, what could be described as a little bit of a revengeful moment, which is, okay, you did something that was clearly against the law, and we're going to do something about it.
But how much action is the Georgia Republican Party going to take against a former Republican president of the United States?
Well, I think the Georgia Republican Party is one thing. I think a district attorney or an election official is an entirely other question. Mm-hmm. So, I think it's good that they're even trying. I don't know that they'll get that far, but it's well worth trying.
Absolutely. Fran, you were going to say?
Yeah, I agree with Alan. I think that... it's the thing that gave that other reader hope. You know, the system has been pretty beaten up, and it's really great to see the system working. You know, this is not okay stuff. He should be held accountable. We'll see how far it goes. And I agree with Alan. It's heartening to see accountability being expected for things that were not okay.
We got this from Dean, who says, I wonder if the panel sees any hope. Any hope of overcoming this current state of affairs, or are we marching toward the doom that seems to be inevitable among the panelists? How do we get out of this? Not in a pie in the sky, hope against hope sort of way, but are there real world solutions that will lead us away from the looming autocracy? Please give those of us that believe there is a way forward some hope. Do you have any hope, Malcolm?
Sure. I have plenty of hope. And I think that the first thing that happened good for us was that we elected Joe Biden president. And now I suspect that by the end of the summer, the coronavirus crisis will be over. I mean, in a big way. They're on target for their 100 million in inoculations by the first 100 days. And they're pushing everything down to the local level with football stadiums and CVS pharmacies about to start, vaccinating Category 2 type people, which is general public, which is just going to be incredible. And once we get back to that sense of normalcy, a lot of that grievance of you're making me wear a mask and that's a bad thing because you're evil liberals, well, just seems ridiculous. The problem is that the people we're talking about have this ability to self-victimize and shift like on a moment's notice. But I think it'll take a lot of it out of it. The country will, be able to rejoice a little bit. The economy will explode. We're going to have a baby boom. I think there's a lot of hope out there.
Vera, hope.
Yeah, I think as somebody who is in education, my focus, of course, will be to have many, many conversations with my students in classes and get new case study information into our conversations about civic engagement and personal responsibility in terms of creating a safe, inclusive equal neighborhood in which you live. So these are the kinds of things I think that we have to all emphasize to sort of reach young people, to give them a sense that they can make a difference for the future, because it is a lot of young people from a lot of different walks of life who made a difference. I mean, young people, I mean, 30s, 20s, and younger, who made a difference in this election too. And they want to create a future for themselves that is more productive, more inclusive and thoughtful than what we've had the last 4 years. So I think I have hope in terms of, you know, the educational environments making a difference.
Fran?
I think this is a great question. I think that, you know, on this program, and not just this time, but all the time, we're talking about big, giant things, things of which, you know, all of us, no matter what our level of influence is, you know, we're limited. But, you know, the place where we have a lot of influence, and it turns out that it matters, is our own life. So there's a bunch of things you can do in your own life that will, you know, like be a force of good and like bring us hope. You can wear a mask. You can vote. You can use two-phase authentication when you do Gmail. You can call people out. You can raise your own data literacy. You can speak truth to power. You can, like, not buy a baby monitor where the, you know, internet password can't be changed. There's a bunch of ways in which you can make your life and the lives of the people around you more like what you think it's supposed to be. And I think if people have enough hope to try to make the things they have some control over better, you know, it can't hurt. I think it's got to help. And I think it's the only thing we can do. You know, I'm not an elected official, so I don't have that kind of influence.
I think I have to read up on this baby monitor thing. Alan, your thoughts on hope?
Well, look, I don't think things have really changed, to be honest with you. I think we have a divided country. I think we've had a divided country for a long time. I think what happened is that some people who were on the lower end of the spectrum decided it was time to vote and to take it back. We had some major figures who helped in doing that, and I am hopeful that that will continue. But if anybody's asking me, are we going to have a kumbaya moment when we all get together, hold hands, and sing by the campfire, that ain't going to happen. I think we're going to have what we've had since the Civil War, and I think and before that, and I think that's what's going to happen. I have hope because I saw what happened in the election of Biden, as Fran says.
All right, we just have a few minutes, a couple more letters, and then we will wrap up for today. Thanks for keeping me company every morning, says Dan. Is if this was anyone other than Trump, they would easily be convicted. Imagine for just 1 second if Obama had done the exact same thing. The Republicans would be absolutely livid. Malcolm, you made that point earlier. Megan says, go ahead, Alan. Malcolm, I'm sorry.
I said I'd be convicting Obama if he did any of this stuff.
It's too partisan. Megan says, while listening to the trial yesterday, I had the following fantasy. Trump walks into the chamber and says, stop. I'm with you. I've been playing a role to test the strength of our democracy. It was a stress test on our democracy stance. Like Scrooge at the end of the movie, Trump is embraced by all. The celebration would be glorious. I'm not kidding. I just kept thinking about that. Well, you know.
Which I say,
I would love Trump just walking in. I would love Trump just walking in and saying he wants to testify on his own behalf.
Which he can't do because he would be lying before Congress, and that is criminal.
You think he cares?
Interesting question.
But that was a good fantasy to have. I applaud.
I love that fantasy.
Whatever get you to that point. Gail says, black people have been disenfranchised for over 400 years. We haven't stormed the White House. We have always marched and protested for equal rights, asking America to live up to its promise of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for all, not just for ourselves. We did not create this. That from Gail.
That is correct.
And we go to Amy, the insurgents are little boys with guns and ammo. What else can they do with all those guns? If you have a gun, you have to be able to use it to threaten and kill people. They have an insurgency. It's fun. The firing range has gotten boring and tired of hunting deer. It all goes back to the failure of gun control. Anything on that?
That's true.
I think it's right. I think that's right.
All right. Let's see. Allison says some of the Trump supporters were. I don't know if I don't know if still are after. All right. There's a lot of this that doesn't make sense. I'm sorry. I'm going to skip that one because I don't see words that I understand.
Check your letters.
Yes. Thank you. We go to Tom, who says, I'd like to throw another adjective into Malcolm's list of Trump attributes of racism and bigotry. Misogyny. He's notorious for not only disrespecting women, but also for wanting them to be oppressed as all the minorities he despises. To Trump, women are objects for exploitation and sex. Finally,
I just comment on that? How many women actually participated in this insurgency on the Capitol? There are maybe
One in seven, is that right?
Yeah. So this is, and they're deeply involved in fundraising activities, organizational and logistical efforts. So it is shocking to many of us when we see the misogyny within some of these militia organizations, how many women do support this kind of idea of supremacy and support these extremists. So I just wanted to point that out.
Well, thank you. We are out of time. I want to thank everybody for being with us this morning. Alan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you to Malcolm and Vera and Fran. You are all great. Thank you very much for your participation this morning. We'll continue after this short break.
Well, thank you.
Thanks, guys.